Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 22nd, 2021. Well, if you've been following the news lately, you know that our president wants to build lots of electric vehicles that requires lots of lithium to make those batteries to go into all of those shiny new cars. Late in the administration of the former guy, there was a rushed process by which the Bureau of Land Management granted to a company called Lithium America a permit to build a destructive lithium mine in northern Nevada at a place called Thacker Pass. So this is last January. In fact, the former guys, on January 15th, they granted this rushed permit to a corporation to dig up all this lithium. About the same time, what's called a land defense camp was established in this area where the mine would be. And the area where the mine would be is called Thacker Pass, although the Indian name is Pihimahun. We'll correct that if I got it wrong. Anyway, there was a land defense camp established in January at the site of this lithium mine, to be constructed lithium mine. So over the course of months, more and more people would show up. There was a need to have some rudimentary latrine facilities, especially for older indigenous people. Fine. Some of those were built. But recently, the Bureau of Land Management has generated a shocking $49,000 in change fine for the founders of that land defense camp in northern Nevada. $49,000 for putting up some wooden latrines. Okay. That's the backstory. And so we are pleased to get the actual story from our friend, Max Wilbert, who is one of the co-founders of that land defense camp up in northern Nevada at Thacker Pass, and is also an author, and I would describe him as something of an environmental philosopher, a guy who thinks deeply about environmental issues, and that, in a sense, is what's driven him to the Thacker Pass mine site, although he's much more concerned with immediate day-to-day things right now. So, Max, welcome.
Thanks, Ted. It's great to be with you.
So tell me, I gave the little story about where you've been, where things are going. Did I get it right? Tell me, what do people know? What should people know about what's going on in Nevada?
Yeah, well, first, the big picture. This lithium mine would be about 28 square miles, almost 8,000 acres. It would last for something between 40 and 100 years of mining and involve blowing up a mountain, digging 400 feet deep. It's essentially a mountaintop removal mine, except it's not for coal in this case. It's for lithium. And because it's for lithium, and lithium is an essential ingredient in electric vehicles and in grid energy storage batteries for wind and solar backup, this is being promoted as a green project by a lot of people. You mentioned that Biden is promoting electric vehicles. It's not just him. There's a lot of people who really believe this is the answer. And, you know, it may be true that transitioning to electric vehicles would reduce the greenhouse gas emissions of our transportation system. I think the problem that people aren't recognizing is that reduction would be of a pretty small magnitude, and it would come with a whole new set of problems, right? So instead of the harms of fossil fuel extraction, which are very serious. You know, I've been involved in opposing the fossil fuel industry and helping our culture to move away from that for many years now. And I'm certainly not proposing that we stick with fossil fuels. But people don't recognize that this lithium causes its own problems. We've seen huge issues with lithium mining in Argentina, in Chile, in Tibet, in Australia. Massive amounts of water use, pollution, the destruction and displacement of indigenous communities. It really looks just the same as the fossil fuel industry. You know, if you are If you are a wildlife community, a group of wildlife facing the destruction of your home, it doesn't really matter whether the bulldozers are there to set up the latest fracking field or to put in a lithium mine. It feels the same, right? The impact is the same. And I really don't think that we're going to consume our way out of the problems that we face. I think that, you know, when I got started in the environmental movement 20 years ago or more, I sort of grew up, you know, with that ethos in the family that I was raised in. You know, it was all about simplicity. It was about the understanding that we don't need all these fancy high-tech gadgets. We don't need cars. We don't need the latest and greatest consumer goods. You know, we need clean water. We need air. We need good food. We need community. We need to take care of each other. And beyond that, a lot of the other stuff is just luxury items that aren't really necessary. But we've been sold this whole story that they are necessary. And a lot of people want them. There's a lot of investors, a lot of money to be made with this lithium right now. Mm-hmm. It's a huge booming industry. There's sort of a bottleneck when it comes to lithium supply right now. So the car companies want it. And one of the places where it's found is under this mountain in Thacker Pass in northern mm-hmm. Nevada. So we set up camp, as you mentioned, on January 15th to bring this to the public, to try and have this discussion as a society. What direction are we going to go in? You know, what path are we going to go down? Are we going to double down on a consumeristic, you know, energy wasteful lifestyle? Or is this sort of crisis of climate change and the move away from fossil fuels an opportunity for us to reflect more deeply on what we actually value, you know, as individuals, as communities? What's really important to us? Is it really that important to us that we have cars and the ability to travel 1,000 miles, you know, over a right. weekend if we want to?
I guess I agree with you. I think the way I say it is that, are we going to reprise the exploitive and destructive techniques that brought us the fossil fuel industry and redo that and just have it be a green industry? Because, I mean, the lithium yeah. circumstance is just one of many where there's rather destructive methods that are used. And it's a question of what kind of world are you building? So I think it's a yeah. great discussion to have, right? And I admire you for putting yourself on the line to sort of force the discussion, and put it into people's head that this is worthy of thought and consideration. So there you go. Hmm.
Well, thanks, Ted. Yeah, that means a lot. And I think that's well said. So it was January that we set up the camp. Within about 5 days, the Bureau of Land Management was out there. They sent out their law enforcement rangers. This is federal land, public land. That's managed by the Bureau of Land Management. Technically, it is Paiute and Shoshone land that was seized illegitimately, by force, simply by the rights of manifest destiny by the U.S. government. Treaty.
Max, before we go yeah. on, so the Bureau of Land Management is a division of the Department of the Interior, right?
Correct.
And the Bureau yeah. of Land Management makes what kind of decisions? I mean, what are they managing?
Well, some people joke that the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, really stands for Bureau of Livestock and Mining. The BLM comes from the merger of two different agencies. One of them was the Grazing Service. The other one, I'm forgetting the name of it, but it was some other agency that existed, you know, like the Department of Defense used mm-hmm. to simply be called the Department of War.
Right.
So the Bureau of Land Management manages a huge amount of land in this country, mostly in the western United States. They're also responsible for subsurface mining rights.
Mm-hmm.
So in many areas of the country, if you own land, you don't actually own what's underneath your land. You only own the surface, basically. Right. And the subsurface mineral rights can be taken by a fracking company or a coal company or whatever. BLM's responsible for permitting that and managing that process.
And the land that is in question here, as you just to reprise what you were saying, I mean, this is ostensibly federal government land, right? Public land is not owned by anybody in particular. The federal government, quote unquote, owns it, but the history is a sorry history where essentially the land was taken from the indigenous people, which in this case, I think, is the Shoshone Paiute tribe. I was looking at something called the Duck Valley Reservation. Is that the part of what it's in?
Yeah, there's about 10 different reservations within a decent radius of this. Mm-hmm. The closest is the Fort McDermott Reservation. Okay. You've got the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, Winnemucca Indian Colony, Burns Paiute Tribe, okay. Duck Valley, as you mentioned. Uh-huh. So there's a wide variety. And just the location of where a reservation is today doesn't necessarily correspond to there was one tribe and they lived in this area and then they all went to that reservation. And that it's not linear like that. The history is pretty mixed up. A lot of tribes were destroyed or displaced. They were marched, you know, long distances so that deliberately taking them away from familiar lands, you
maybe,
know,
maybe you can tell me this
places.
The, so that this just goes like sort of orthogonal to everything. It's my understanding that, and I am, I guess I should just preface this by saying I'm embarrassed to, that I don't know this, but I think the Cherokee tribe, who were originally in Georgia, and Andrew Jackson marched them out to the Midwest on the train of Trail of Tears. Is that how? And so I mean, this thing you got from watching cowboys and Indian shows when you were a kid has nothing to do with where those people originally came from. There's been a great amount of turmoil over the last 150, 200 years, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the arguments that we're making in court around this fight, because the BLM is saying that they properly consulted with tribes. They have a legal obligation to consult with tribes. And what their consultation consisted of, for the most part, was three letters sent to three different tribes that were not responded to. You know, we're making the argument that that's inadequate, that doesn't fulfill the law, which says that you have to meaningfully consult with tribes. And it explicitly says in the law that, and in the guidelines, that one letter is not enough. If people don't respond, there might be a good reason for that, and you need to try again.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see where that argument ends up playing out in court. But, you know, more broadly, the reality in this region is that, you know, Nevada was settled and colonized pretty heavily starting in the 1850s and 1860s. And that was because of the mining industry, in large part. You know, this was in the lead up and the aftermath of the Civil War. You know, Nevada is known as the battle-born state because it was given statehood in large part to gain federal government access and higher royalties on revenue from silver and gold mines in Nevada, to help pay off the massive debts that were incurred during the Civil War. So Nevada is sort of known as the battle-born state for financing the repayment of these Civil War debts.
Mackerel. Learn something every day.
What's pretty fascinating, you know, this history is that many of the soldiers who fought in the Civil War or who wanted to fight in the Civil War but weren't able to make it out east in time to participate in those battles, joined the United States military and ended up fighting Indians, ended up fighting Paiutes and Shoshones and Bannocks and other Native people across this region. And so throughout this era of the 1850s, 1860s, you have larger and larger waves of white settlers coming into these territories. And what they're doing is they're overhunting the game. They're, you know, the deer populations are crashing, the ducks and the geese and the migratory birds, the sage grouse, antelope, the buffalo. There were buffalo in this area, the fish, and the white settlers are setting up their homesteads and their mining camps in the best locations where there's year-round water sources and so on. The Paiutes and the Shoshones and the other Native people in these areas, their livelihood is being destroyed right in front of them. They're seeing this massive incursion of people into their territory who aren't living in balance with the ecology they're destroying. And you know, it's a settler culture. This was, you know, there were explicit desires on the part of government and on the part of business at this time to come into new lands and exploit the natural resources to make as much profit as possible. And so, you know, conflict is inevitable at that point. And so you have a long series of wars that break out in this region. One of those that's pretty notable in the case of Thacker Pass is called the Snake War, which took place from 1864 to 1868. So Civil War ended in 65. So right as the Civil War was winding down, this conflict was ramping up. And on September 12th, 1865, there was a massacre of at least 31 Paiute indigenous people in what is known today as Thacker Pass, where the U.S., a unit of the U.S., the 1st Nevada Cavalry, snuck up on a camp with women and children and elders and opened fire on them at daybreak and killed at least 31. We've been trying to reconstruct as many details of this as we can. There are a few shocking things that we do know, you know, one being that one of the survivors is the direct ancestor, the great, great grandfather of the family that is today helping us fight the Thacker Pass lithium.
Really?
So, you know, the people who were killed in Thacker Pass were this man, his name was Ox Sam. They were this man's brothers and sisters, parents, maybe his children, I'm not sure. Those bones are in the soil. That blood is in the soil there. And this was not only missed during the NEPA process, where federal agencies like BLM are supposed to investigate the history and archaeology of lands like this and figure out what has happened there that might be significant. Not only did they completely miss this, but then they insisted for months in court and publicly that there were no massacre sites in Thacker Pass. Now they've started to walk that back, and they're claiming that this site is not relevant because the location where it began is about 600 feet outside of the project boundary.
Really?
And this, despite the fact that there's documented references to people fleeing the village site or the campsite where the massacre began, and this quote-unquote battle or massacre, more aptly, playing out over miles and miles and hours. So we're working in the courts to try and get the courts to recognize that this is, you know, not just a side issue. This mm-hmm. is a very important historical site. I mean, if somebody was proposing to build an open pit mine on Gettysburg, right? Yeah,
you'd have some questions.
Similar time frame. People would be very concerned about it. And this is an important site in American history, in the history of this country, that can't be papered over, it can't be ignored, and it can't be swept under the rug.
And in fact, to destroy it adds insult to injury and continues the same kind of terrible history that's been that caused it in the first place.
Absolutely.
So that's a fascinating story. Tell me this, just to give people a sense of Thacker Pass. I, of course, have never been there. I went to Google Maps. I found Thacker Pass. And to my mind, looking down from that satellite view, it looks as if there's a high plateau and then the land falls off rather steeply. And Thacker Pass is like this river gorge that basically brings you down to the lower level. Is that a fair description of the geography?
It looks like that from the satellite view. What it actually is, it's a bit different. When you're on the ground up there, what you see is Thacker Pass is sort of this broad saddle. And to the north of it is the Montana Mountains. To the south of it is the Double H Mountains. And both of those are sort of these high plateau mountains that rise up to about 6,000 or 7,000 feet. So between the Double H Mountains and the Montana Mountains, there's this broad saddle, which is Thacker Pass, and it rises above the Quinn River Valley to the east and the Kings River Valley to the west. But it's sort of this moderate in-between elevation below the high mountains to the north and the south, but far above the valleys to the east and west.
but it's literally a path through those mountains. It's a way to get, which is why, of course, it was identified.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
That's a, I mean, I guess that's an interesting context to keep in mind, that the history in ownership and damage that has been done in that area is very difficult to put your hand on, but very meaningful, right? And that it demands respectful investigation before you go in and make what I guess I would describe is that this lithium mine is going to look a whole lot like the Alberta tar sands, right? We just rip the guts out of the earth and you have big machines there and et cetera, et cetera. So, okay. With that as preamble, tell me the story of what's gone on recently. So I guess given the what we've just said, the description of Thacker Pass, the people, what sort of the historical stakes are, what has happened in the last few months that's of interest, and in particular the kinds of finds we talked about before?
Yeah, well, the case is continuing to evolve. There are now three lawsuits that have been filed against the project, one by a local rancher, mostly centered around water issues, one by four environmental groups that are looking at the environmental harms of this project, and now one by two different Native tribes and a Native community organization that are alleging that the government did not properly consult with the tribes and has not dealt with these issues around the massacre and so on. So while this battle has begun to play out in the courts, we're seeing the escalation of repression from the Bureau of Land Management. My good friend, Will Falk, who I co-founded the Protect Thacker Pass Camp with, he's actually an attorney. And he's representing the Reno Sparks Indian Colony and the people of Red Mountain in their lawsuit against the Bureau of Land Management.
Again, these are nearby reservations and groups of Indigenous people relevant to the Thacker Pass
location. Yes. So in the wake of this new lawsuit being filed with these Native plaintiffs and with Will representing them, the Bureau of Land Management has come to Will and myself, us two as individuals, even though there have been hundreds of people involved in this camp, and has threatened us with $49,890.13 in fines.
Why am I not surprised you know that number down to the 13 cents?
So that was the bad news that we got on September 15th, which was the 9-month anniversary of starting this whole project. BLM is coming after us, Will and I, as individuals, and we had heard privately behind the scenes beforehand that BLM was threatening us with this. At that time, we didn't go public with it. Instead, what we did is we basically went to the BLM and we said, we think this is a bad idea for you to do this, because what it's going to look like to the judge is that, you know, you got a lawsuit filed against you and you're mad about it. So you're going to throw a tantrum and try and fine, you know, me and the attorney who's filed the lawsuit against you, $50,000 in retaliation. Yeah. As individuals. And, BLM didn't like that. They didn't buy into that argument. So they went ahead and laid the fine on us. So now we're trying to figure out, how do we deal with this? How are we going to push back against it? We plan to appeal the fine. There's a process through a sort of administrative, it's not a real court, it's not a real criminal matter at this point, but it's sort of an administrative court process.
I got a question. I mean, how is it, they can't just decide to fine you, right? There has to be a pretext. This has to be some rule that they consider has been violated. And then it sounds as if they're judge, jury, and executioner and can just hand you a fine for doing something on federal lands. They have that authority?
Yeah. So what they're alleging basically is trespass. And so they're alleging that these latrines, which were built, were trespassing on federal lands, and that therefore they can fine us that they can charge us for what would be a fair market rental value of that land. And that they can fine us for the costs of them investigating and resolving the issue and for stabilizing and rehabilitating the land. So actually this $49,890.13 number is the minimum that we're looking at. And it could go higher depending on how things play out. So we're fundraising, we're raising money in case we do have to pay these fines, but we're going to fight every step of the way because we don't think it's right. And there are a couple reasons why. One is that the first time BLM rangers told us that they didn't like us building these latrines up there, we told them these bathrooms were requested by Native elders who are up here participating in ceremony. We're not here to try and make impacts on public land or break the rules just to be, you know, frivolously breaking them to be jerks or something.
Like Eamon Bundy.
But. Right. Yeah. Regardless of whether or not BLM likes it, there are hundreds of people coming up to the site to participate in ceremony, to take part in events. And those people have to go to the bathroom. So, you know, we thought we're going to do the most responsible thing possible and build a very small, lightweight, temporary latrine to deal with human waste, because that is going to be a lot more sanitary and a lot more hygienic and a lot lower impact to plants and animals and the land than having all those people wander off and just, you know, poop on top of the soil, right? You know, right out in the open or dig a hole or whatever. I mean, a lot of people don't know how to do that right when you're in a backcountry setting. So we really thought we're doing the most responsible thing here. And BLM said, well, you need a permit for that. And we said, how do we get a permit? And they proceeded to ignore us. And we did not just ask them once. We asked them about 5 or 6 times. They said, well, you need a permit for that. We said, okay, great. How do we get a permit? And they ignored us again. And they ignored us again. And they ignored us again. And then in their letter to fining us, they had the audacity to say, they have not applied for a permit. So, you know, we think that this is pretty silly. It's pretty stupid. It's a pretty blatant case of just trying to intimidate and harass us. And we don't think it's very likely to stand up in court because, like I said, we've tried to conduct ourselves really well, really politely, professionally in all our interactions with these people. You know, I've said, I can't tell you how many times I've said to these BLM rangers, I'm not here to fight with you or make your guys' lives hard. We're here to try and stop this mine. And, you know, if we need to get a permit for something, for example, then we'd like to do that. And, you know, what,
no sympathy,
what can,
right?
Yeah. What can you conclude when the response to that is the response that we've received, except that this agency is just, you know, a front for these mining companies, essentially.
Yeah, that is a sorry story as far as the BLM goes, right? And that's not a happy thing. Well, tell me, so what if people wanted to help, if they wanted to get involved, where should they go look? What can they do? What are the stakes? I mean, the story sounds interesting. It sounds like one that's going to go on for a while. I'm sure there's like a long, in fact, I know there's much, much more behind this. Tell me, if people wanted to learn more, where would they go and what can they do?
Well, people can go to our website, which is protectthackerpass.org. They can also find us on social media. And on the website, on the social media, you can find the donate link so you can give to our fundraiser. Even if we don't end up having to pay the fine, we may end up having to pay a lawyer for helping defend us in this issue. So we definitely need the financial support. If folks are interested in coming out and visiting the site and spending some time there, it's beautiful going into the fall. It's incredibly gorgeous out there. The temperatures are nice. The first winter storms haven't hit yet, so it's not too harsh. And we want people to come see what's at stake, because it's one thing for me to tell you, But it's completely different to actually stand on that land and go take a walk by yourself and just think all this could be gone, by this time next year. It hits you on a different level, you know, and I think too often these debates are intellectual and not sort of embodied as humans, as one animal species among so many others on this planet. So I really encourage people to come out and visit the site. But definitely check out the website, sign up for our newsletter, follow us on social media. We're also trying to build pressure on politicians, especially the Nevada politicians, Deb Haaland, the Secretary of the Interior, administration.
Deb Haaland, everyone has heard of, right?
Yeah,
she's the one who oversees the BLM.
Right? Yep,
so that's correct. Why she's you want to talk to her, right?
Yep. Yep. And the Biden administration from the beginning has said, we want to do a better job of working with tribes. We want to consult with Native people better. The appointment of Deb Haaland being one example of that. But it can't just be, you know, the face, right? It has to be real action. And so, all the Native folks who I've been talking with who are working on this campaign really want Deb Haaland to come out to visit the site, to talk with people, to mm-hmm. speak out on this issue, to get involved at some level, because it's just not right what's happening.
We need to put it down there, Max. That's a very interesting discussion. What I'll do is I'll put up links on the blog, the MCAN blog at massclimateaction.org/blog, to the Protect Thacker Pass, the various social media contacts, Deb Haaland, how to get in touch with the Bureau of Land Management, et cetera, et cetera. Dear listener, this is an interesting and I think a kind of leading edge case that we will be dealing with. This kind of issue we'll be dealing more and more with as we go forward. And Max, I love the idea that, you know, I intellectualize stuff because I'm sitting here on the East Coast, right? I've never been to Nevada, but I mean, the sort of humanity of the whole thing is important for people to keep in mind. If you have questions about the podcast suggestions, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects the communities most affected in order to safeguard our collective future. So, Max, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.